We're at 3 o'clock. Welcome, everyone. This is our Darwin Day lecture. Darwin Day was officially yesterday. Darwin was born in 1859, he publishes, at the age of 50. He was born in 1809. That's Darwin. That portrait was, it's a print, an etching, made from the portrait that was done the year before he died in his garden at Down. He's got his great cloak on. He's holding his hat. Beside him is his associate, Huxley. And those two portraits hung side by side in Stuart Biology for years until we received them. That's Peter Redpath. He was the donor who we've benefited from. In 1881, he gave the money to build this museum, the oldest museum in Canada. We try and honor Darwin Day with a special presentation. This year it's Andre Kostopoulos from Anthropology, and he pushed me into this on a hot morning in July. He was getting his coffee in the basement of the library, and he said, I really want to do a Darwin Day lecture. I'm getting these results from my modeling, and it's just showing me that humans are really making bad decisions. from all my Paleoarctic material, and I said, I think they're still doing it, Andre, you know. You want to talk about it to more people than just me. So that's why he's here today. It's not his first Darwin Day. A few years ago, his talk title was, What makes us 99% chimp? Yep. And our guest of honor that day was a chimp. Today we have a few other guests of honor with us. Some are minus their lower limbs, but Andre will tell you all about them. Andre was an undergrad at McGill. He graduated in 92, did his master's at UDM. Doctorate was in Finland. Postdocs in Connecticut.
Yeah, London.
Came here in 2003. You'll find him most of the time in the Faunal Archaeology Lab, but this year and last year he is Associate Dean of Arts. Mm-hmm. And most often in Dawson Hall. Dawson Hall is where our founder lived. Dawson is Sir John William Dawson. And I guess you might even be sitting in his office or his kitchen, his scullery.
I'm in the kitchen, yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of links at McGill, and we'll let Andre take you into the deep past links today. Welcome, everyone.
Actually, that little story that Ingrid was telling is very relevant to our presentation today. Yes, I was at the Tim Hortons in the basement of the library, and here I was holding my morning coffee with three sugars in it and talking about how humans tend to make decisions that are not optimal and maybe not even fitness enhancing at all. And I was an example of that right there. Oh, I also usually get a double chocolate donut. So, yeah. So that tells you something about where some of these ideas that I'll be talking about today might be coming from. Scientists also have various sources of inspiration, and daily life is one of them. Okay. Now, today I'd like to discuss with you some of our ideas about what makes us human and how some of them might need to be revised. One of the things that we think about ourselves as humans is that we're intellectually and mentally superior to the rest of creation. Right? That's one of the things that we think of. What makes us human? Well, we're cultural. We make decisions. We have thoughts. We solve problems, right? That's really what makes us human in many ways compared to other creatures. Certainly, if I want to put it in technical terms, our reliance on culture as an adaptive tool is unusual. We rely on culture to an unusual degree in among the organisms that we know of. And that is one characteristic that makes us human. But we associate that with being smart and with making good decisions. In fact, the whole field of human behavioral ecology is founded on the assumption that humans are selected to make fitness-enhancing decisions. Right? That over time, we have been selected to really do things that make sense for us. And that's why we do so well as humans. Is that always true? That's what I'll be talking about today. Certainly, we have a lot of computing power up in our skull. And that computing power has evolved over time. You know, we can clearly see, I'll talk about the evolution of the brain a little bit later on. We can clearly see that there is a trend toward greater encephalization among humans. Our brain gets bigger relative to our body size. And that gives us lots of computing power. And we use that computing power. My main question is, what do we use it for? And how did it evolve? Right? Since this is a characteristic of all humans, basically. Humans are all nearly identical in terms of brain and in terms of computing power. This means that it's probably a trait that's under strong selection. Right? In an evolutionary system, usually traits that are not very variable in a population, traits that are very widespread and that fall within a very narrow range of parameters, those are traits that are under strong selection. They're not allowed to vary a great deal by the environment. Traits that are more neutral, traits that don't matter so much at the moment in the current environment, have more scope to vary. And that's where we find a great deal of diversity. But in terms of the brain, in terms of the reliance on culture, for humans, we find very little diversity. In terms of the contents of culture, contents of cultural systems, then there is a great deal of diversity. But as a sort of macro scale anthropologist, what I'm struck by is not so much the diversity of individual cultural systems, which is very interesting in its own right, but what strikes me is the uniformity of the reliance on culture as an adaptive tool, and the ways in which culture generally operates through, for example, the solving of environmental problems through the use of technology, whether it be a stone tool or a nuclear power plant. It's really the same approach to solving an environmental challenge. And that's what we'll be talking about today. So if humans are so smart, why are we always in so much trouble? I've just finished telling you about how, as humans, we pride ourselves and define ourselves with our intellectual ability. Even whole fields of science are based on this. If you think back to, this goes back very deep. If you think back to Malthus, who was Thomas Malthus' essay on population, who was one of the inspirations of Darwin, he writes that humans are defined in some way by their capacity to make predictions, to adjust ahead of time to conditions and to changing conditions. Humans can make decisions and project forward into time. And that, to him, is one of the key characteristics of humans. So this goes back very deep to the sort of founding documents of the social and also the biological sciences as they pertain to living organisms and to humans in particular. On the other hand, there's a sort of countercurrent to that in Western philosophy, for example, and in Western social thought, that humans are inherently destructive, right? That humans are... just think about what people say about what happens when humans enter a new environment. Right? You have this whole idea. You look at North America 15,000 years ago, and it has a lot of herbivore megafauna running around. Right? It has a lot of mammoths and things running around. And then you look at North America 8,000 years ago, and it has no more social megafauna but humans running around. And people often make an association between this, almost naturally. Right? They say, oh, well, humans appear, megafauna disappears. Think about the example, very well known now because of Jared Diamond, the Easter Island example of humans walk into a new environment and they just overexploit it until there's complete ecological collapse followed by complete social collapse. So there's this in the middle of our sort of hubristic boasting about how intelligent we are and how that makes us special and different from other organisms, there's always this nagging little voice of doubt in the backs of our minds that points out actual outcomes, observed outcomes of what happens to humans. And we have other examples. Everybody knows that if you extensively overfarm an area like Southern California or the U.S. Southwest in general, what you get is increasing salt content of soils, which is bad for agriculture. So the more you try to help agriculture over there with the techniques that we're using, the more you're hurting it in the long term, right? The more you increase your short-term payoff, the more you decrease your long-term payoff. Everybody knows this. So what are we doing about it? Overfarming Southern California. And we know from archaeological examples, right? Archaeologists will tell you, yeah, that's basically what happened to the Sumerians. You know, they did exactly the same thing. That's why Iraq is a desert now. Iraq was not always such a desert. Now it is, mainly because of this phenomenon, because of what we're doing in Southern California. And everybody in Southern California says, isn't that fascinating? You know, tax dollars at work. We learn so much from archaeology. So this is, you know, I mean, it's funny in a sense, but it can also have some fairly dramatic consequences for humans as a species. And to me, it poses a paradox. Right? And the paradox is up there. If we define ourselves through our intellectual capacity, which is undeniable, we do have all this computing power, much more than many, many other organisms. And we use it to adapt to our environment, much more than many other organisms. We use it to adapt to each other much more than other organisms. We live socially in a way that many other organisms don't. So how come we keep having these disasters all the time? And of course you're talking here to a child of the, you know, 60s and early 70s, and I grew up sort of comfortable with the idea of nuclear annihilation. I grew up comfortable with the idea that I went to bed one night and then, you know, you just said, okay, see you in the morning if they haven't set the bombs off. And maybe that's why I'm aware and conscious of this paradox, right? Because at the same time, in the 60s and 70s, that physics was the height of human development, right? And certainly in the Western mind, physics is the queen of the sciences, and science is the hallmark of being human. So physics was the leading light of the Western world, really, when I grew up. And if, you know, you were encouraged in school, well, you can try physics, and if you're not very good at that, then you can fall back on other stuff. Obviously. Usually that tells you a little bit about me as a student, especially in high school. But that's another issue. At the same time that we had this discourse, we were living every day with the potential that physics would put us out of our misery permanently as a species. So that to me is a very interesting sort of paradox. And I'd like to explore some of that today with you. I'm not sure how I'm going to use the various props and things. Okay, after this introduction, so who are we? Well, humans, we're biological beings, of course, in a material world, but we're also cultural beings. We're biocultural beings. And the way I usually try to convey it to students in class is that it's not enough to say that we're biological and cultural. It's not enough to say that we're biocultural. Really, we have to put the emphasis on the hyphen in biocultural, because that's where it happens for humans. Now, when I say biological, of course, who we are as individuals and who we are as groups and as a species we inherit part of that from our parents, genetically, right? We inherit a set of genetic instructions that is going to be expressed in a particular environment and provide us with a morphology, right? The same genetic material expressed in different environments will give different results because of plasticity, because of interactions. But generally speaking, part of the instructions that make us who we inherit biologically from our parents. But that's not all we are. We also inherit socially. Some of what we are, we've inherited from others through non-biological means. Right? So that socially acquired component of our phenotype, that socially acquired component of the morphology of the whole individual, not just the physical individual, but the behavioral individual, is culture. Right? Culture is the socially inherited component of the phenotype. It's what we learn from others. And there are two kinds of learning that are generally defined in the literature, and I'm getting increasingly skeptical about the distinction between them. Literature talks about social learning, which is what we acquire culturally, what we inherit culturally, and individual learning. So individual learning, very simple. Okay, I use this story all the time, so some of you may have heard it. I see some familiar faces from past classes, so I'll try to come up with some new material for next year. But in my office in Leacock, there's something with the floor, and I have a big metal filing cabinet in there. And every time that I reach for the big metal filing cabinet, I get an electrical discharge. I get a shock. So over the years, I've actually learned, so through individual learning, right, this is because I hurt myself and I want to avoid that. I haven't learned this from anybody. So generally what I do is I will walk up to the cabinet and hit it with my elbow and then open. Because the electrical shock is somehow, I don't feel it as much. It's either camouflaged by the pain of hitting my funny bone or I don't know, it's discharged differently. Maybe if you reduce the distance between your skin and the charged surface faster, you get less of a discharge. Maybe the arc is not as long. I don't know. I didn't go into physics. But generally I do this, and that's my pattern of behavior. That's individually learned behavior. Now, if one of my teaching assistants watches me do this and either knows that it's because I want to avoid an electrical discharge or thinks that this is, you know, let's use some sort of prestige-dependent copying here. It says, that's the way to be a prof, you know, and that's what I want to be. So they stylishly walk up to any filing cabinet and hit it and then open it. And it launches a worldwide craze. That is social learning. This has become part of their cultural repertoire. They've inherited that behavior from me. They've inherited that trait, or at least the instructions that generate that trait. They've inherited them from me, from someone else, non-biologically. So that's who we are. You know, we're a mix of biologically inherited material, of culturally inherited material, and individually acquired material. That's who we are. So humans, as I was saying in the little introduction, humans rely very heavily on culture as an adaptive strategy. In fact, without cultural transmission right now, there are no humans. Right? You can't at this point, you know, humans have passed the point of no return in terms of cultural transmission. You can't take a newborn and leave them to their own devices. They will not survive, period. So humans really need, it's become a necessary condition for humans to exhibit this cultural transmission. It's not enough to inherit the biological material from your parents to be a human. And you will never become a human that way. You'll die before you have a chance to. You also have to acquire usually over an extended period of time, usually over a period that's longer than the lifetime of most organisms around us. You have to acquire culturally material from both your parents and from others as well. And as any parents in the room will know, you also acquire cultural material the other way around, like from your kids. You inherit behavior from your kids, definitely. So the cultural transmission differs from biological transmission in a number of ways, and one of the ways is the roots that it takes. It can be other than vertical and other than from parent to child. And of course, as anyone who's walked around in the weather today will know, we use culture to adapt to our environment. We don't wait for a thick pelt to be selected from generation to generation to live up north. We don't wait for the ability to hold our breath for 6 weeks in order to fly to the moon, for example. Humans use culture and culturally acquired traits in order to adapt to environmental challenges, and we rely on those as well. Foresight and insight learning. Well, we pride ourselves on that. I talked about that a little bit. We pride ourselves on our ability to solve problems, and we think of cultural evolution, and we think of the use of culture for addressing environmental challenges in terms of foresight and insight. Right? We think about it as problem solving. So we picture ourselves in an environment with a certain challenge facing us. And we have certain tools available, and we try to figure out how to overcome this environmental challenge using the material available to us. Right? So we think our way through challenges. I'll come back to that. But that's the way we look at ourselves generally. If I just take a moment more on the previous slide, this would suggest a system in which, unlike biological evolution, which is undirected, right? It works with random mutations that then get selected by the environment. This would suggest a cultural evolutionary system in which there is direction. Right? Whatever new traits we come up with, whatever traits we add to our cultural repertoire, are somehow generated in response to an environmental challenge. This is not the case in biological evolution. Right? The biologically inherited part of us is unplanned, so to speak. There is variation in a population. New variation accumulates through mutation. The mutations don't occur because they're needed. The mutations don't care about what the environmental conditions are. They get selected by the environmental conditions. And if a certain mutation occurs, then it becomes available and it can be selected. If it's needed to solve a certain environmental problem, and it doesn't occur by chance, then it can't be selected, and we all die. So that's how biological evolution works. There's a possibility, at least, that because cultural evolution is, at least in part, but I'll come back to that, at least in part, what we add to our cultural diversity is a planned response to known environmental challenges. There's a possibility that much of cultural evolution is actually directed. Right, that it's a response to environmental challenges in a way that biological solutions are not, because it's not random. Because the agency that generates the new variation is aware of the problems. Right? Whereas in biology, the agency that generates the new variation, the random mutations, is not aware of the environment. So that could be one of the key differences, but I'll come back to that. I think I should go back. I skipped one. Right. Well, that's just what I said. Okay. Good. So we are smarter than we think, apparently. But, as the slide said, let's consider a simple deterministic system. And in fact, I'll consider two simple deterministic systems. But let's start with this game of pool. Why is it a game, pool? Any ideas? I mean, there's a reason why some people of low character enjoy hanging out all night and playing this thing while drinking beer, for when another fitness enhancing decision, no doubt. Why is it a game? What makes it a game?
Culture.
Well, culture is it is part of culture, right? And it was generated as part of culture. But why is it a game? Sorry? Well, we can learn from it. Yes, definitely. Play-directed behavior, very important for learning. Yeah, it's challenging. Why?
Because it's strategic. You have to use your... You have to use whatever you have in front of you to be able to challenge your party.
To try to achieve... So challenging, right, means try. You try to solve a challenge. And the key word here is try, because if you were able to solve that system every time just by looking at it, and you were able to implement your solution to that system, there wouldn't be much of a game, would there? You could always make the perfect shot that's needed, and you could always figure out what the perfect shot that's needed is. Can you do that? No. That's why it's a game. So you have two limitations there. I can't figure out what the right shot is. Why not? Why can't I figure out what the right shot is all the time? Sometimes I can. But sometimes I'll be playing and I'll say, I've just made three perfect shots, right? And I suddenly realize, oh no, 3 shots ago I should have done something else. Why? Because we have trouble looking forward. Even in a very simple deterministic system, we have trouble figuring out the long-term consequences of our actions and of our decisions. So if we have trouble doing it here, think about trying to solve social problems. Let's end world poverty. You know, interestingly, in terms of politics, often the disagreements are not about what the goals should be. Right? The goals are, we call them motherhood and apple pie statements. Everybody agrees that this would be nice if it could happen. The disagreements usually happen when you start talking about how. Because some people are saying, well, the obvious decision to make to reach this goal, to end world poverty, is to do X. And someone else will say, well, no, because if you do X, you're getting on the wrong path. We need to do Y. And the other person will say, well, no, if you do Y, clearly, you know, you're going to go wrong also. That's where the disagreements are, because we have trouble looking forward. That will become important. The other, of course, is a problem of implementation. Even if we could look at this table and figure out exactly the development of that system over time, right? We can predict accurately all the time the outcome of every shot. It would still be a game, because what's left in the game? Actually making it happen, right?
Skill,
that's right. Actually making it happen, motor control. And we have a problem with that as well, right? So even if we knew, let's grant that we have excellent ability to predict what's going to happen as a result of our actions in the system, controlling exactly those outcomes is going to be still a problem. There's another useful game that I use it in class, actually. We just do a demonstration in class. I see some younger faces in here, so some of you may not remember pickup sticks, but some of you will. I think I was probably the last generation that played pickup sticks on rainy afternoons, on the weekend or in the summer or whatever, because we didn't have anything else. You know, oh, we have nothing to do, Mom. Here's a bunch of sticks. Have fun. And we did. We had tremendous fun. So you just have a bunch of sticks. and you drop them. You put them in a bunch and you drop them. And they end up mixed up on the ground or on a table. And the object of the game, for you kids out there, the object of the game, believe it or not, is to remove the sticks one by one without disturbing the pile. Right? So you want to remove one stick and not change anything else in the pile. And then you want to remove another stick, and you take turns. And of course, there's a winner. Well, there are several winners because there's one loser, the first person who disturbs the rest of the pile. And why do they disturb the rest of the pile? Because they've either failed to anticipate a consequence of their actions, or they have accurately anticipated the consequences but failed to control the application. Right? They have not succeeded in implementing their planned solution. So this raises some questions about the importance of our intentions and our willful actions in a system, and especially our actions that are aimed at solving particular problems. And if I diagram this, it looks something like this. You have a problem. Okay, we're cultural beings, right? We have lots of computational horsepower. So we find solutions to things. That's what makes us human. So we have a problem. We make a decision. Our decision in the system will have a few well-identified, obvious, intended consequences. Maybe it will solve the problem that we're intending to solve. But because we live in a complex system at all levels, it's also going to have unintended consequences. It's also going to have a number of unknown. Here, I don't want to go Rumsfeld on you guys, but it's going to have, you know, known, unknown, unknown, unknown. It's going to have a bunch of consequences that are unintended. And I think experience tells us, I mean, I don't have any numbers on this, obviously, but I think experience tells us that even immediately, unintended consequences will outnumber intended ones. And even if they don't, the fact that we don't know about them, maybe sometimes until it's too late, or not at all, makes them actually more important than the intended ones. And also, over time, they multiply. Over time, the intended consequences over time will actually decrease in number and importance. Right? Oh yeah, that problem is solved. We did that, and it's having fewer and fewer impacts. The unintended consequences will actually multiply. Like in the game of pool is the perfect example of that. And there's another factor that's important to mention here. Since we live in a complex system, one of the characteristics of complex systems is sensitivity to initial conditions. Right? One of the reasons that there's a game of pool, a third reason, is that no matter how much you try to control initial conditions, right, the way the board is at first, there are going to be some very slight differences, perhaps undetectable to us, but real nonetheless. And those differences will get amplified over time. So you start from one set position. That's what the rack is about. That's what that triangle thing in the game of pool. You put all the balls in there, and you put it on the table at a set place. So there are actually efforts in the game of pool to remove variability, to increase standardization. You put the cue ball always in the same spot, and then you try to hit it the same way to generate a certain outcome. But even if you magically applied the same amount of force on the same vector every single time, you will still get different outcomes over time, and increasingly divergent outcomes over time, because the initial conditions themselves are not always the same. Right? Because you can't always control precisely the initial conditions. This makes it difficult. This makes it even more difficult for us. Even if we were really, really good at limiting unintended consequences, which I would argue we're not, even if we were really good at controlling perfectly the outcome of our decisions, we would still have to deal with the problem that we live in a complex system, and that the conditions that we think obtain at the moment we apply a solution are not exactly the ones we think are actually there. Right? There will always be undetectable differences. So even if we model, even if we, as accurately as we can, get a picture of the system in order to make a decision, we will still be applying our decision in a system that's slightly different than the one that we are thinking about. And that will create divergent outcomes. And we have a few examples of that that I talked about at the beginning. Spread of the Black Death. That's always a popular one. Was the trading of European silver for Chinese silk, was the intention to spread the Black Death? Unless you're even more paranoid than I am, you will probably say no. It could be some huge historical conspiracy theory, but maybe not. Let's grant that it isn't, just on the off chance. Most likely, the desired outcome is not the spread of the Black Death. But the spread of the Black Death is probably one of the most significant consequences in terms of human history of this system. Now, the intentions were completely other. Individuals have intentions, groups have intentions, negotiated among the group members, and they engage in certain behavior that's directed at solving some proximal problems that are around them that they see, or maybe even some long-term problems that they see. And they implement some solutions to that, some of which involves building this massive system of trade between Western Europe and Eastern Asia in the Middle Ages. And it has a major consequence for them. Everybody dies, or at least a quarter or so. That is not the intention here. And yet, it has a major, major impact on, just do a quick Google search on consequences of the Black Death. Everything is blamed on the Black Death, from I don't even want to speculate. Everything is blamed on the Black Death. Desertification I talked about. Another quite classic, very human one. Let's build big walls to keep the water out. That way we can live safely and, develop economically and socially and all that. And what is the actual outcome? Well, the actual outcome is, again, everybody dies. Not the intended outcome, for sure. The other problem, overfitting. Okay. Now, one of the reasons that culture is thought to be such a useful adjunct, and that's usually how it's put. I mean, I wouldn't put it that way, but that's usually how it's put, is such a useful adjunct to biological evolution, is that it allows us to adapt faster to our environment than biology would, especially for an organism like humans that has such a long gestation period, such a long maturation period, and such long spacing between births. I mean, that's basically what did in the mammoths, I think. I mean, the humans maybe pushed them over the edge a little bit, maybe a shove. But really, think about it. The mammoths are at the end of the Ice Age. Things are changing very, very rapidly. The environment is changing around them extremely rapidly. And they probably, if they're like modern African elephants, they have, 18 months gestation or something? You just can't reproduce fast enough for the diversity that's required to adapt to rapidly changing conditions to accumulate in your population and then be selected. Remember, that's how biological evolution works. Either you have it when the change hits, or you don't. If you don't have the solution to the problem when the change hits, then you're gone. So what you need is accumulation of diversity in order to deal with problems. You don't know what problems are coming down the road. Right? Which American president is it who said, if you see 10 boulders coming down at you from the mountain, the 11th one is going to get you? That's exactly right. That's how evolution works, basically. So you have this pool of diversity in your population, and changes happen, and sometimes you have the right bit of diversity that's going to save your bacon that moment. If you don't, you don't. That's it. Culture, because it changes, it allows you to change, behaviorally at least, it allows you to change faster than your generation time. Within a lifetime, you can come up with a lot of solutions and discard them and adopt new ones and so on and so forth. You can do that on a daily basis, and I know some people who do. They change the way they do things all the time. Some people are very conservative and never change the way they do things. But the point is, you can. And so one of the ideas is that this sort of ability to learn from others and to acquire traits socially allows us to adapt faster to our environment. What is the problem with that? The problem might be that, and Darwin actually wrote about this problem of overfitting, I think. He wrote something like that if organisms, through natural selection, adapt very, very fast to very local changes and become very, very adapted to their local environment, they might actually be missing the larger trend of environmental change, and they might be overfitting their local conditions. And then when those conditions change, they might actually be at a disadvantage. So if you fit system change too fast under certain environmental change regimes, like that one there, then you might actually, when there's a sudden reversal after a long-term, fairly stable trend, you might actually end up at a disadvantage to those who adapted more slowly to environmental change. As long as that, you see that little arrow there? As long as that angle, right, between the fitness of those who fit the curve really, really closely and the fitness of those who don't change so fast is not deadly. In other words, if you can survive until that reversal, you'll be fine. And in fact, if you can survive until that reversal, you will have an advantage over those who fit the environment much, much more closely. And this happens to look a lot like the environment that humans have evolved in over the past, 3 million years or so. What does it suggest? What does it look like to you? This curve with long trends and then sudden reversals. We just went through one of those about 15,000 years ago. It's basically the ice ages, right? It's the glacial cycle in which humans have evolved for a long time. And this suggests at least the possibility that adapting really fast to local conditions, as long as there's some lag, you know, you're not adapting perfectly. And I don't think anyone will argue that we're perfectly adapted to our environment at any given time. Otherwise, there'd be no evolution, basically. So no one will argue that we're perfectly adapted to our environment. So as long as there's some distance and you're trying to adapt really, really fast, some unspecified lower rate of adaptation will actually be advantageous when the reversal comes. So this at least allows us to ask the question, is it in fact the case that culture is so successful with humans because it allows us to adapt faster to our environment? The basic fact is that it's demonstrable that under certain environmental change regimes, adapting faster is not always better. There is a possibility that, you know, humans adapt through culture at a rate that is optimal for this kind of system. But the argument that faster is better doesn't always hold up. So we can at least start asking the question, okay, so if it's not maybe to adapt faster, or if it's not entirely to adapt faster, then what is culture for? And by extension, when I'm asking what is culture for, I'm really asking what is the big brain for, right? What is the computational horsepower that we've evolved in order to rely on culture so heavily, what is it for? Because relying on culture, if you think about it, now let's work this out for a minute. So relying on culture means that you're relying on socially acquired traits, right? You acquire stuff from others, which supposes what? There have to be others. that you're in touch with, that you're in contact with. And if the point is to accumulate diversity, right, because you want to be equipped to deal with change as it happens, you need the way to get as much diversity as possible culturally is to be in touch with as many people as possible, as many groups as possible, for as long as possible. And this does require computational horsepower. Right? You have to be able to maintain social relationships with a wide diversity and number of people and groups. And so you need that big brain for that. That's one of the things that it does. I'm not saying that's why it evolved. I'm saying it's certainly one of the things that it does. It allows you to do this. It allows you to have very wide social networks, which is a characteristic of humans, that allow you to have access to a lot of cultural diversity. And this cultural diversity equips you to deal with environmental challenges. So we're talking really about the evolution of the brain in this case. And maybe I can talk about these guys now. We can see it very clearly just looking at the table, right? If we look at this is our ancestral line. Some will argue whether this guy, Neanderthal, is directly in our ancestral line, but is at least a close cousin, if not directly in our line. I'm not going to commit on that today. This is a discussion for another day. But, clearly if we take the extremes of this distribution, and here I'm going to maybe surprise you, because the useful way for our purposes to look at human skulls and hominid skulls in general is not this way. It's this way, right? Because when you look at it this way, from the top, you clearly see what has been going on in human evolution for the past 2.5-3 million years. What has been happening? You see it? What do you see? Sorry? Yes, definitely. What else? Well, it's getting bigger for sure. Yes, absolutely. It's getting bigger because we have a bigger brain. There's something else happening as well that's very important. This, that's right. This here, you see this? This is usually referred to as a post-orbital constriction. It just means it gets narrower behind the orbit, so post-orbital constriction. This post-orbital constriction is absent from the modern skull. Why? Because there's all this material up here. There's a whole frontal lobe that's there that wasn't there before, and that's allowing us to do all these things, like have 600 friends on Facebook, which I can't understand, by the way. I mean, I look at this and I say, wow. So I don't know how. I don't think I can even keep track in my head of 600 people. That's why you have Facebook, I guess. See? Okay, I've learned something. That's good. So that's one of the very important things that's happening. And it's happening with, if we look at, sort of this intermediate guy, erectus, you can see that the post-orbital constriction is reduced, but it's still there. And then we have our good friend, maybe grandfather, maybe great-uncle, Neanderthal, in which it's basically gone. The difference with Neanderthal is that the vault, the modern vault, sort of here, rises higher straight from the orbit than in Neanderthal. In Neanderthal, you have actually a little bit of a slope there, because this indicates the continued reorganization of the brain to emphasize the frontal lobe. So this guy, for example, on average, Neanderthals, well, it's a bit meaningless to talk about averages because the samples are not really samples. I mean, out of the material that we know, the average brain size of a Neanderthal is actually larger than a modern human, but it's organized a little bit differently. So it seems that for a while, the trend is toward bigger. And then after about maybe 100,000 years ago, the trend is not so much toward bigger, but it's toward internal reorganization. And that's an interesting question as to why that would be so. And now we can go back to our, that's our ice ages, basically. So just to show you that it's the same kind of curve with long, steady trends followed by rapid reversals, basically. And at the rapid reversals, the conservatives get their payoff, sort of thing. You know, they've been resisting change, and they've been doing less well than those who stay very close to the trend. You know, the trendy people get all the rewards for a while, and then the geeks get their payoff at the end when there's the. Yeah, you can see some of the genesis of, you know, some of these ideas here. Somebody got it. And that's the result of an agent-based computer simulation in which we have a population of agents, some of whom are really good at deciding what is good for them and some of whom are not so good at deciding what's good for them. So this is a very simple environment in which there's basically temperature. There's one environmental variable, temperature, and it changes over time on that pattern. So long, steady trend, rapid reversal. And the agents have, in the system, there are innovations that become available. And the innovations can either make you more fit to the current conditions or less fit to the current conditions. It's random. There are some agents who can tell by looking at the innovation whether it's going to move them toward a more comfortable place or toward a less comfortable place. And then there are agents who are quite clueless and they don't, you know, they don't really know what is good for them and what is not good for them. And here we have the M-axis there, 20, 40, 60, 80, 100, is the overall level of discrimination in the population. Right, so as you see, it starts quite high. So most of the agents, there's a distribution there, but a lot of the agents at first are very good at telling what's good for them. What happens after, like, three ice ages or four ice ages? Look at where the pale band is. That's where the bulk of the agents are. See how it migrates down? Because at every reversal, you get a bunch of trendy agents just being wiped out and a bunch of conservative, geeky agents being selected, basically, because they have this little advantage at the reversal. So always, you know, basically, even if we always knew what's good for us, it would not necessarily be good for us. This suggests, you know, that there's at least the possibility that we've evolved to that this limitation of ours, right? The reason there's a game of pool is an evolutionary outcome. The reason there's a game of pickup sticks is a result of human evolution, because it capitalizes on some of our evolved traits that keep us from always overfitting our environment and getting caught out at environmental reversals. So maybe it's in fact, we're in fact selected to not know what's good for us. And now if we combine that idea, here I've completely lost track of my time. I'm sorry, Ingrid. I get carried away with these things. Some of my grad students would say, you know, I get too carried away and I'm telling you a bunch of lies. But they're platforms from which to reflect on human evolution. How about that? Now, if we combine that with the idea of cultural evolution, if humans are selected to have limited ability to figure out the consequences of their actions, right, so that we don't get caught out, so that we're not always as perfectly adapted to our environment as we can, right, so that when suddenly we have a rapid change in conditions, we get basically caught out. If we're not very good at discriminating between fitness-enhancing and other innovations, right, we see people do things around us and we either pick it up or we don't. What does that say about the importance of our actual decisions? And what does it say about whether cultural evolution is more or less directed than biological evolution? The idea with biological evolution, remember, is that there's random mutations. If the random mutations occur, the variation accumulates, and either you have the right variation or you don't when an environmental change happens. Cultural evolution, the tendency is to think about it as much more directed, right? To think about it as problem solving. So you think of yourself as designing a solution to an environmental challenge and then implementing it. If we're not very good at making decisions that actually fit the challenge, and that our decisions and actions mostly have unintended consequences, then how really different are they from random mutations? That's a very, very interesting question to me. How different are they from random decisions? I see some quizzical looks there. Let me try to take it another way. You want to give an example? Go ahead. Sure. Stock market. Yeah, of course.
We gave darts to a monkey, and the monkey was throwing.
And did better than the
throwing darts at stocks. He picked those stocks, invested. They did as well as the.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised at all, given the McGill Pension Fund. Maybe we should hire some monkeys for the McGill Pension Fund. Or at least have them as, you know, a backup plan. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. Because we are in a complex system. And basically, if over time, or even a short time, the unintended consequences of your actions swamp out the intended consequences, and they change your system in more fundamental ways than your intended consequences, then you might as well be making random decisions. And in fact, conceptually, you are making random decisions, because you're not good at determining which solution fits which problem. So you know you have a bunch... Yeah?
Wouldn't random decisions cause a lot more immediate negative consequences?
You mean like global warming?
Something more short-term.
That's pretty short-term. Okay, I'm an archaeologist, right? So I've been telling you guys about... I'm thinking in terms of, you know, the short term, the past 2 or 3 million years. Sometimes I study adaptation of the evolution of adaptation of northern populations to environmental change, and that I do basically in the present, the past 6,000 years. Right. So we have to think in terms of different scales here. There's an evolutionary scale, in which short-term means something, and then there's a daily immediate scale in which it means something else. But even at that scale, you know, daily scale, a couple of hundred years is not very many generations. Right? Some of us in this room can ask our grandparents about what was going on 150 years ago because they were there. So this is actually short term, you know. So anthropogenic global climate change is short term. It's a few generations, and it's basically a few people making decisions to solve problems that they see around them, having global unintended consequences that you're all going to be driving through going home now. So it's, you know, basically this, to me, this problem of the status of human decisions in an evolutionary system is very, very interesting. You guys know Jean-Baptiste Lamarck? Lamarck was an early evolutionary theorist, and he was a pre-Darwinian evolutionary theorist. And his idea was that organisms physically adapt to their environment through use and disuse of parts. Right, so the giraffe, for example, stretches its neck to get the highest leaves that are scrumptious and that where there are fewer competitors. And generation by generation, because of this differential use of the neck by some giraffes who have more of a vital force animating them, they have offspring that have longer necks and so on and so forth. So that the acquired characteristics, acquired traits, are inherited, right? That's what's required for Lamarck's system to work. Biologically, we know that's not the case. So biologically, changes acquired during life as a result of development are not passed on. So Darwin knew this, of course, being, as they would have said at the time, a keen pigeon fancier. You know, clipping tails of pigeon generation after generation does not make the tail shorter. If you're interested in breeding a variety of pigeon that has very short tails, what do? You select. Hence, Darwin's idea for selection, natural selection. So you select them with short tails and you have them interbreed until you get, you know, some of the offspring will have longer tails than the parents, some will have shorter. And then you pick the ones generation after generation that have shorter tails, and eventually you end up with a population that you're happy with and that you can show off at the Crystal Palace exhibit. There's a notion that culture basically works on a Lamarckian model. Right? Because I think about a solution to a problem and I implement it, like hitting that thing there, that gets passed on, right? And there's a directed aspect to cultural evolution. Yes, there is. But how important is the directedness of cultural evolution if, in what I call the short term, what you call the long term, the decisions that are passed on and that are modified according to local conditions, generation by generation, and here we don't mean biological generation, but some kind of mental generation, generation of ideas, if those are equivalent to random decisions in their final, impact on the system? That, to me, is a really fascinating question. Is cultural evolution basically Lamarckian, or is it basically Darwinian? And I think that some of what we see strike that. I think that most of what we see on the nightly news would argue to me that it's, in fact, more Darwinian than Lamarckian. If it was more Lamarckian, we would be in much less trouble than we are. So why the big brain? If it's not to allow us to adapt faster to our environment, I think we've seen that. If it's not to allow us to fit our environment more closely by making better decisions, then what is it for? And maybe I can use this guy, because if I don't use him, Ingrid will not be happy because she had to, carry him upstairs. So I will use this guy now. For a long time, the study of human evolution was basically built on scenarios that privileged the evolution of the brain. It was the so-called big brain first hypothesis, right? That the evolution of the brain drives everything else. And that if you were looking for the earliest hominids, our earliest ancestors, you should look for an early creature that had ape traits plus a big head and a big brain. Right? So in 1911, for example, when a skull and a jawbone were found at Piltdown, in England. It's a hoax, yes. But in 1911, very few people were saying it's a hoax. Some were. But in 1911, when Piltdown was discovered, it made perfect sense. Because people were expecting big brain and ape morphology or non-human ape morphology under that big brain. So brain, and then under the big brain. And incidentally, in physical anthropology, paleoanthropology especially, the evidence is usually classified into two types. You have cranial and postcranial. So that gives you an idea of the importance of, you know, the cranial evolution. So that made perfect sense at the time. It took until the 1950s for a diligent graduate student to discover steel filings in the teeth of the lower jaw to make it, you know, look more convincing. But throughout that period, you know, 1920s, 1930s, more and more stuff like this was coming to light. And we have it here. Good. So Raymond Dart, for example, in Southern Africa and others in Eastern Africa were discovering little creatures like this. And those little creatures, interestingly, had a foramen magnum, which is the fancy Latin term that means the big hole. Foramen magnum, you know, big hole. That had their big hole vertically coming down from the brain case. And this is the part through which the spine goes to hook up with the brain. So what does this suggest? Suggests bipedalism, right? Suggests upright, suggests this sort of morphology that humans have. So some in the 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, increasingly were suggesting these little guys, what they're telling us is that we should really be looking at the postcranial for the evolution, for the early evolution of humans, and not worry so much about this because this came later. And this was a big sort of reorganization of thought among anthropologists, because you're saying, okay, wait a minute, we have bipedalism first, we have hands, you know, free hands with opposable thumb first. The whole time there was a sort of a Lamarckian idea that humans had become somehow intelligent with their big brain and figured out that, you know, they could use their hands. And through, you know, through use of the hands to make things like this, which these guys were doing, this one is about 300,000 years old, were making hand axes like this and other kinds of tools, that if you can, you know, you're figuring out, you're sitting there with your non-human ape postcranial morphology and your big brain, and you're thinking, damn, if I wasn't a prisoner of this ape body, I could really conquer the world. And generation by generation, by, you know, trying it, you're saying, okay, I can't really hold this thing yet, but my kids, they'll be able to, like, joint a mammoth no problem with this thing. And that was basically the picture of human evolution at the time. But Raymond Dart and others were saying, maybe we should be worrying about this because it looks like we have, you know, basically ancestors of ours. And then that was the question: are they ancestors of humans, or are they, you know, some other kind of thing? But gradually the consensus grew that they were human ancestors, and they showed modern postcranial morphology much earlier than they showed modern cranial morphology. In fact, the takeoff in brain size, if you look at the fossils, happens at a time when the postcranial morphology is largely modern. You know, they're little, you know, but still not outside the range of modern human variation. It takes someone who really knows what they're doing to pick out, for example, 400,000-year-old postcranial remains from a modern collection, from a collection of us. But anybody can pretty much pick the skulls apart and say, okay, this is not us yet. But the rest of the body, wow, you're really very early on. You have to know what you're doing in order to tell the difference. And so this was resolved a little bit, I guess, in the minds of the anthropologists as late as the discovery of Lucy in 73. That's why it was so important, you know, because when Lucy came along, people said, okay, yeah, this is settled. You know, the big brain really evolves later and and then the question becomes, well, why, how, if it's not to allow us to escape our ape bodies and achieve the potential we know we have, then how does it happen that we have these little bipedal things that use their hands and make tools before the big takeoff in brain size? What is going on here? And I think what's going on is culture. I think what's going on is the importance of culture, not as a tool to adapt faster to the environment, not as a tool to track environmental change better, but as a tool to have greater access to a greater diversity of solutions to problems. And the more people you know, the more people you can stay in touch with, the more strange cousins who live out in the woods and do this weird stuff you have. You know, this is not autobiographical. Well, maybe a bit. The more of those you have, the more likely you are to be able to meet a challenge head on. So, wow, this unexpected thing happens. I don't know how to deal with it, but my crazy uncle has been doing this thing, nobody knows why, for years, and he's convinced that, you know, it's fantastic. And suddenly you realize, wow, it really could be useful to help us survive the next winter in the face of this famine brought on by the new ice age, which is upon us, I have to tell you. Yeah.
How does the increasing brain size fit in with the timeline of speech?
Speech. So, yes, staying in touch with people, acquiring from others, speech is really useful for that, isn't it? It kind of changes the whole nature of social exchange. The bottom line is there is no timeline for speech at the moment. We have no idea. Certainly, by the end of the last ice age, humans have articulate language and are using it. How far back before that? No idea. Do these guys have some kind of articulated speech? No idea. These guys, yes. These guys, probably. It's very hard to tell, but it's a key part of the puzzle. But there are other ways of communicating, right? Our ape cousins, chimpanzees and such, communicate a lot through social grooming, for example. They use vocalizations, they use, you know, body language, all kinds of stuff. We also do this, plus we talk to each other. We do all these things, plus the speech. And what the speech allows us to do, really, I mean, there's Clive Gamble, or is it James Steele? One of those British guys, anyway, refers to the release from proximity. Right? Talks about a critical moment in human evolution when humans acquire the capacity, and this means, you know, the brain power, basically, acquire the capacity to maintain social relationships in the absence of face-to-face contact so that you can stay in touch with distant groups, so that your sister-in-law, who lives two valleys down, you don't forget her, right? And you do maintain a lifelong social relationship with her, even if you never meet her again. And maybe your kids or their kids are going to still have that social relationship. Maybe they'll meet twice in their life, but that relationship will exist. And if it's needed, it'll be activated right away. So this is a very important moment in human evolution, and speech probably has something to do with that. Speech helps also with, it allows us to encode those items of variation, right? If we can explain them to each other, we can say, yeah, this guy does it this way, and I'm not quite sure why, but I can tell you about it, and I don't have to show it to you. You don't have to go see him. I can tell you that he does it that way, and that might actually turn out to be important. Because it contributes to increasing the size of our available pool of diversity. And evolutionary success is all about the available pool of diversity. So my thought here is that maybe as humans, the growth of our big brain equips us to come up with a whole bunch of potential solutions to problems. And then we argue about them. But it doesn't equip us quite all the way to deciding effectively which one we should use, which one is the right one. Because if we did have that capacity to know which one is the right one, it would actually work against us in the long term. And here I do mean the long term as a species. If we're just bright enough to generate a whole bunch of possible solutions, then we're doing well because we have diversity in our system. Because we don't know what tomorrow's problem is going to be, right? And we don't even know, because we're in a complex system, we don't even know how the solution that we think is the best will actually work out. It may create more problems, or we may have to fall back on another one when it fails. If we only come up with the best solution, we are less well equipped than if we come up with 50 bad ones, basically, in a Darwinian cultural evolutionary model, right, instead of a Lamarckian one. Well, that's a good note to end on, I think. That kind of summarizes the argument, I think. Yes?
Regarding the technological, what you described just now with those skulls in the mind, I just saw this about the evolution of technology, how our CPUs became bigger, and now they're being compressed and using smaller equipment in your iPods and everything, they're much smaller.
Yeah.
And it just has direct correlation to that. And at the end of that discussion, they said that our dependence, not our use of technology, but our dependence on technology will be the downfall. And it kind of made sense because what you're saying, it doesn't add to any of it, but I mean, to the Darwin theory, it doesn't add too much to it.
Sure.
As far as technology is concerned, maybe we are relying on it too much. And if, even though I'm saying that we're going to rely on a computer to tell what our future is going to be, and
Skynet. That's all I have to say. And there's another point about that that's very important. Because if you look at the evolution of sound reproduction, up until very recently, it was a race for fidelity. And fidelity meant big systems. Right? In the 1980s, if you had a good sound system, it was the size of, you know, the size of a bookcase, and it had lots of lights and buttons on it. And the goal was to have high fidelity sound reproduction. You don't see too many of those around anymore. Why not? Because the goal now is to have your music on the metro. And fidelity, there's actually been a fantastic decrease in sound fidelity over the past 10 years. I mean, my son who's 15 years old, his tolerance for really crappily encoded MP3s astounds me. It's like, we used to... It's also bad music. But that's another point. That's another lecture. Maybe next year's Darwin Day. I can talk about the evolution of heavy metal. But that's another question. Yes? Do you think we're still subject to biological natural selection? My answer to that is, why should we not be? Of course, culture, our reliance on culture, insulates us to some degree from biological natural selection. Right? There are some things that we're actively working on. Like, for example, we wear big jackets in the winter. We don't get selected out of the population because we don't have thermal regulation that can handle minus 20 weather, right? So, yes, there is some insulation from natural selection, from biological natural selection, that comes from reliance on culture. However, there's also some stuff that's around us that we're not doing much about. Like, for example, or that we can't do much about. I would love to see, maybe it's out there and I've just never seen it, but I would love to see a study of lung function, for example. You know, of the evolution of lung function from 18th century to now. Because our lungs are dealing with a very different atmosphere than what they were in the 18th century. And I can tell you, if you look at late 19th, early 20th century, we're right up to the 60s. If you look at newspaper stuff from London, you will see every day massive numbers of deaths from respiratory ailments. And I saw a study once where, you know, they used to have these yellow fog days that they called them or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something very scary, like from a science fiction movie. Yellow fog day, I think it was called. And these were just days when the smog was so intense that people died. That's got to impose some selection on your population. Definitely. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff, like diet. You know, diet has changed. So that's going to impose some selection on your population as well. So I think we are subject to natural selection in ways that we don't understand, because if we did, we wouldn't be. So really it's the 11th boulder, the stuff that's going to get us. So yes, I think we are very much. There's no reason to suppose that we're not. There are ways in which we insulate ourselves from natural selection, definitely. But there are ways in which we don't know how, and there are ways in which we're not aware that we should. Yeah?
On the map of the Black Death, 1347, there was two spots where it says barely touched or not touched at all in turquoise.
Yeah.
One of them, I think, was around Germany. The other one
well, let's
was
go look.
Southwest. I couldn't see where it was.
Let's find out. So let's see. Let me go to the slideshow. We'll see it more clearly.
Just above Portugal,
eh? That reminds me of something. Oh yeah, no, it's not. It's not quite Basque country. Yeah, southern France, and over here, area partially or totally spared. Well, certainly, you know, a good first guess would be that it has to do with contact networks.
Well, apparently, it was around Germany, was spared because of the mountains. Usually, people were so sick by time they go on mountains.
So, yeah. So there are a combination of natural and social barriers to contact is probably what's going on there.
But the other one to the south?
Yeah. Looks a little bit too north for Basque country. I don't know, but that's interesting. And if any MA students are in the room, that would be a good, you know, good topic to look at.
Haven't they started with HIV research saying that where there was kind of the end of the road,
yeah,
where the Black Death seems to have almost a natural resistance to it? They're preliminary studies.
So end of the road. That to me suggests, again, density and frequency of contact. Basically, linkages, that's right. So linkages, the more linkages you have, the more diversity you accumulate, but also the more perils you face. But, you know, you face more perils, but you're better equipped to deal with them. If you're at the end of the road, in network terms, if you're at the end of the road, you have access to less diversity, so innovations that become available in one part of the system don't necessarily become available to you very quickly, but threats also don't necessarily come and visit you as quickly. So fewer threats, less ability to deal with existing ones. Trade-offs, right? There are some advantages and disadvantages to being central to the system and to the network, and some advantages and disadvantages to being peripheral, definitely. And this is true in evolutionary terms as well.
Wouldn't being conservative would kind of work against human spreading to other parts of the world? Like, if that conservative making decision, wouldn't he say, oh, I should go visit that area?
Okay, so wouldn't being conservative work against this quite extraordinary human colonization of the globe? Right? Humans expanded out of Africa a first time about 1.8 million years ago, 2 million years ago or so, and spread very, very rapidly from all of Africa, you know, to Europe, to East Asia, to sort of land-close parts of Oceania. I mean, you know, Malaysia and all that, Java. So that doesn't argue well for basic conservatism, except for one thing. Loring Brace has this idea, and others also. You know, one of the important ideas in human evolution is that what keeps all these daughter populations of the dispersal out of Africa, sort of a single species, a single group, in essence, is that we're all part of the what they call the culture ecological niche. So even though we're facing very different environments, we all use the same tool to deal with those environments, and that's culture. So the fact that we're all using culture means that the selective pressures on us, independent of what is in our environment, the selective pressures are on how we deal with our environment, the method we use, rather than on ourselves as biological organisms. Basically, that would suggest then that the environment itself, unless it's very extreme, is kind of a neutral factor for us because we deal with it culturally. It's an idea that has some merit.
Like Europe and all that, that cold places from Africa, which is not cold. Like,
yes.
That's a very different environment.
It is a very different environment, but we're using exactly the same tools to deal with both. Because, of course, Africa is not cold, but it's hot. And it has all kinds of other problems. Like Australia, for example. Australia is nice and warm, but everything there will kill you. Pretty much. Africa, you know, you have tropical environments and equatorial environments have their own problems. And speaking as a northerner myself, you know, I by experience, having worked in the north and having been to North Africa, for example, I would much rather meet a bear in the woods than some kind of huge insect. I can't deal with the huge insect. I can deal with the bear or the wolves or the moose. Someone else with a different experience, you know, will react differently to that. But this is cultural also, right? Because I've learned to deal with the wolves and I've learned to deal with the bear and the moose. It's not alien culturally. So it's not the environmental pressure itself that we're adapting to. It's the method we use to deal with it that we're adapting to. So in that sense, no matter where we go, it's basically the same to us, whether it's in orbit, you know, on the space station, or in, you know, equatorial Africa, or in Hudson's Bay. It's basically no different to us because we use the same method to deal with it that keeps us under the same kinds of pressures and that keeps some traits under strong selection, such as the big brain, such as the ability probably to use language and to connect with others far away and to maintain social relationships in the absence of face-to-face contact. Those are very, very important human traits that we often don't think about because we're too mesmerized by our ability to build stuff. Okay, thank you. Did I get over time?
90 minutes, it's your standard. Whew. And thanks for this year's Darwin Day lecture, your own skeleton.
Thanks.
And your own dino bag.
You mean that one's not for me?
No, that one I'm going to keep. And I hope you appreciate the Fossil's Tail pre-hominid.
Oh, yeah. Good.
If anyone wants a copy of that, it just published last December.
Excellent. Thanks.
Corrections are welcome.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Thanks for coming. Next year, same place?
Sure.